Las Culturistas is brought to you by the Forever Dog Podcast Network.
Find us and other great podcasts at www.foreverdogpodcasts.com.
If you're loving what you're hearing, subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please write us a terrific review and give us a 5-star rating.
Oh, and Culturistas, don't forget to follow our brand new Twitter at Las Culturistas.
And the Facebook.
Well, if you're not already following Facebook, I don't know what to do with you.
Very good point.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now. Ande, Giacomo Fino Anane, Giacomo Finane.
Ding dong, Las Culturistas calling.
Okay, we've been little readers.
Matt and I are in a little book club, but we sort of fell into this very organically.
Absolutely. I mean, well, to be, you influenced me.
Okay, so I woke up this morning at 7 a.m., and I even stayed up until midnight.
Why
just to
7
see...
a.m.? Just because you...
Oh, I just wanted to, I had an early night.
Okay.
But I even stayed up till midnight to refresh my Kindle to see if Hillary Rodham Clinton's...
Rodham
Clinton's new book, What Happened, or as
what
Matt
had
likes
happened
to call
was...
it, Matt likes to call it What Had Happened Was. Everyone's posting this Fred Willard thing, like, what happened from A Mighty Wind?
Sure.
All our
A Mighty Wind fans out there?
All our Christopher Guest fans. I just read that first thing in the morning and really, like, spent all my extra time. I was, like, supposed to get some writing done, but I spent all my time just reading it, and I was like, God, this is a really fucking good book.
Yeah, I went to the Barnes & Noble, and honestly, there wasn't the frenzy that I thought there would be.
Right?
Like, I really thought there was going to be, like, a whole table of like, only What Happened books. Like, I thought this was this huge moment, but I had to look for the book.
Yikes.
Right?
This is, like, a big moment. Anyway, guys.
I'm enjoying.
I'm enjoying. It's real juicy, and she's getting real. She has a whole fucking paragraph sentence that says, I'd have been a damn good president, and I was like,
yeah.
Yes. And she drops Anne Lamott, Mary Oliver, Les Mis references within the first, like, 40 pages of the book.
And
what more do you want?
I want to say something as a segue.
Okay.
I was reading two books today, actually.
Okay, and is this about
okay,
our guest?
Okay, dual books. Okay, dual readings.
Okay, readings.
Yes, I was reading two books, and both of these books, honey, referenced Kelly Clarkson's hit, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Stronger.
Oh, my God.
Okay, because you know I was gagged when I was reading Earth Hates Me.
Yes.
Today, by our guest, Ruby Karp. And this book is in stores on October 3rd. You can pre-order now, honey.
Yes.
And also, I want to say Ruby is the host of We Hope You Have Fun. It's a stand-up storytelling show at The Beast every month. It's the second Monday of every month. And the next one is on October 9th.
Can't wait.
Just had Janine Garofalo on the show
That's
yesterday.
Amazing.
Can you believe this show?
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable. Pioneer.
She's pioneer.
And she's 17 years old.
She's a junior or senior?
No,
junior. Senior. She's a senior at LaGuardia.
A rising senior.
Rising senior.
At LaGuardia High School.
Yes.
Come through.
And she pointedly references Stronger, What Doesn't Kill You by Kelly Clarkson.
And so does Hillary Clinton.
So you have this in common. You're two nasty women. And we're very excited to have
Ruby
Karp. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, my God. So thank you so much for coming here and being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Ruby, I want to kick things off. Just to get this out of the way, is it annoying at this point when people keep, like, referencing your age? I mean, like, you're only this old?
Yes.
Great. Okay.
Fully.
Thank God. Okay, so we will not... We'll talk about your life, obviously, and, like, where you are at this juncture, but, like... Matt, let's promise.
Okay, sure. But, like, also, enjoy people marveling at your young age while it happens. Because also, like, you will get to this sick place where you'll hit 25, 26 and be like, oh, my God, I'm in my mid to late 20s. What's happening?
Uh-huh.
And then you'll be truly...
And then I'll miss my youth.
You'll miss your youth.
Yeah, absolutely. So enjoy it while it's here, Rube.
But of course I understand, like...
It's gotta be annoying.
When people sort of coddle you into being like, oh, you're a baby, and just like write you off. Yeah.
Well, it's also like, yeah, I'm young and I wrote a book, awesome. But it's also like, no, I wrote a book. Like, it's not about my age.
Yes.
It's about writing and being funny and all of those great things.
Absolutely.
Extolling a lot of wisdom in the book. And a lot of really very cool people have read this book and given amazing, like,
just glowing reviews.
Pull quotes on it.
Pull
quotes.
Got
Amy Poehler on the cover of the book.
Queen Amy. You got Tashir.
Tashir. You got Miss Natasha Lyonne.
You got
Paul Scheer.
The other Scheers.
The Sashir and Paul Scheer.
And she's got a Glazer in the forward.
Yeah, she did.
Alana Glazer.
Come through.
So did you get to hang out with her? Or was it just like an
email?
I've known
Alana since I was pretty young, actually. I did Broad City Live before Broad City was this big thing that it is now, which is insane. They're so awesome.
Yeah. So can you explain, like, how did you get involved in the comedy community so young? Like, well, how did this come about?
Well, my mom started a magazine called Bust in the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
It all makes sense. That's so cool. That's so fucking cool.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. My mom's coming to watch this soon. She forgot. She made me a cream cheese bagel and she forgot it at home, so she went home to get it.
I miss my mother.
But yeah, my mom started Bust, and so she, in like the 90s, was partying with like Amy and Matt and all of them before they were famous, and like Tina, like all of them before they were big deals. So, because they're all like relatively the same age.
Uh-huh.
So my mom and them were all just like genuine friends.
Yes.
And then she was around when they first started UCB.
Right.
And that was also right around the same time she got pregnant with me.
Uh-huh.
And she had me, and we would always be at the theater just because we were like supporting our friends and stuff. But then when my dad left and moved back to Australia when I was 3, my mom had nowhere to go with me because, like, she was a working woman, alone, single. I don't have any siblings. So it was just, like, my mom and I. So my mom would always bring me to UCB and, like, throw me on stage with all of them while she would go cry in the green room.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so I was, like, 3, and they would, like, pull me on stage and just, like, swing me around. And we're like, look, a child. And they would, like, do improv with me. I wasn't, like, conscious of anything, but that was happening. And then slowly I just got, like, really accustomed to constantly being surrounded by adults.
Right.
Oh my God, what an origin story.
Yeah, so you were just really thrust into that atmosphere.
No, yeah, so I literally like grew up just being comfortable on stage and doing improv and literally just constantly being surrounded by comedy.
Oh my God, and your scene partners were these like
legends.
Yeah, yeah. Which I so did not know at the time.
Yeah.
The first time I did ASCAT, well, I did Amy's Smarkles at the Party when I was 7.
Uh-huh.
And then right after that, because I guess I was like a finally formed human being, she was like, you're ready to do ASCAT.
Wow!
So when
you
I
did
was,
the monologues at ASCAT.
Yeah, yeah, monologues. Yeah. No, not improv yet. but when I was 8, I did monologues at ASCAT for the first time.
Wild.
And, you know, at the time I was like, oh yeah, this is just me telling stories like with my friends. But now I'll meet people like in my improv classes or at different job kind of things, and they'll be like, you know, I think I saw you do monologues when you were like 10.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry.
No. I mean, that is like the most precocious of precocious things, is to like be on display, is to like open yourself up like that and to all these strangers. I mean, no. I mean, like, yeah, of course it feels embarrassing, but that's like, I mean, that's so cool though, Ruby. Like, that's awesome. That's really cool.
No, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, like, it was never like a big deal to me because I was just like, this is just what I've grown up doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then I got my own show and I started doing that when I was like 11. But then it got to a point when I was like 14, 15, where I was like, oh, this is like a profession that people do.
Right.
Like people pursue comedy because for so long I was like, I'm going to be a rock star or I'm going to be an actress.
Uh-huh.
And like then I slowly started realizing like, oh, I don't want to do those things. I actually just want to do writing and comedy.
Right.
Awesome.
So then I actually started like really developing comedy and really actually trying to like work towards building a set, building an essay of book things.
Yes.
And then here we are.
And here we are.
So did you go out and mic? Like, and how does that work as like a 14, 15-year-old?
Yeah,
like,
I can't get into any clubs.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So
still even to this day.
No, to this day. I've only, I honestly have not performed at that many clubs in the city. Mm-hmm. Mostly just UCB, The Pit. I did The Slipper Room and I did like one other place. And really that's it because I can't get in anywhere else.
That's wild.
That's gotta be crazy.
That's gotta be crazy. But you're also like, that's like the Beyonce narrative. Like she's, you know, she's walking on stage in heels at 14.
And
like,
let this episode be called the Beyonce narrative.
Thank you. Any
Ruby
comparison
Tarp
to Beyonce, I will take.
Can I tell you my favorite story about Destiny's Child and like them getting whipped into shape by Matthew Knowles? Which maybe this is like a crazy story. but I don't know if you guys knew this, but he would take them out on like 5 mile runs.
Oh my God.
And he would have them sing in harmony the whole time.
Oh my God.
And he would drive in the car next to them. This is true.
Yeah.
And he'd be listening to the harmonies to make sure that they were tight.
I don't know.
So that when they were dancing and performing on stage,
it was like nothing to them.
It was like nothing to them. Yeah. Right, because that's, I guess, how they truly learned how to control their breath, which, to be honest with you, is not so smart. Way to do it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because that's really what it is. It's just, and now you see Beyonce perform at the Super Bowl, and you're like, how the hell would she be the machine that she is? It's because she was literally getting run.
Either your dad makes you run 5 miles and harmonize with your friends, or your mother thrusts you onto the stage at UCB with all of these.
And there we go.
There we go.
Beyonce narrative. Oh my
so
God.
So like is in your comedy, in the comedy that you do, that's got to be. Do you talk about stuff in school? Do you talk about like stuff that you're going through, or do you ever feel like a pressure to talk about like bigger things that maybe other comics are talking about? Like, talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, my thing is, from a very young age, it was very clear that on stage there were lines that I, as a young person, couldn't cross.
Right.
Like when I was like 14 and I started like being interested in like boys and stuff like that, I would like tell a story or two. It would make the audience so uncomfortable.
Oh, right.
I was 14. I wasn't like doing anything like weird.
Sure.
But I would just like talk about like, oh yeah, I have a crush on a boy and this is what happened. Blah, blah, blah. And the audience would feel really weird because they'd be like, I don't want to see a young girl talk about boys and like getting bras and stuff. Like, because for a bunch of adults to watch a child on stage, they feel weird.
Like they're watching something that they're getting in on something that they shouldn't
be. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So especially when I got like older, like 16, 17, it was very clear. Like, oh, I can't really talk about hookups or things that happen that, you know, all teenagers and everyone went through when they were my age. But for some reason, I've found that it makes people uncomfortable to like have me explicitly say all those things. So I discovered that pretty young.
Yeah.
So my mom and I came up with this thing that we call Ellen DeGeneres humor, which is we can't curse.
Yep.
We don't talk about sex or any, not that, it, meh, but like we don't talk about sexual things.
Right.
And we keep it clean, no potty jokes or anything like that.
Right.
Because for me, it's like, I want my comedy to rely purely on the fact that I'm funny, not based on me cursing or me talking about something inappropriate. I want my comedy to purely be me being funny about things.
Yeah.
And that's going to pay huge dividends as you get older and as you do free up that space. Because, I mean, you are setting these limitations on yourself for very good reason. I'm not saying that in a bad way. You're setting these restrictions in order to develop something very specific, and I mean that's all you need.
Well, sometimes it's actually kind of a good idea to develop inside this box because it actually you place rules on yourself without thinking about the rules that everyone else will place on you. It's like I developed actually my own way. I've heard about a lot of people who actually toured doing like Christian comedy.
Oh.
And then when they come of age and they get old enough, they break out of that and they feel the freedom and they feel the individuality to talk about whatever.
Yep.
And because they had so much training, like playing to a specific audience or like doing whatever, I don't know. It for some reason just kind of sets them free in a way.
It's that base layer. So Ruby, you should tour some Christians.
Oh, totally. My bat mitzvah rabbi would love.
Yes,
that.
Absolutely. Yes, of course.
Talk about your bat mitzvah. Wait, what was your Torah passage?
It was Jonah and the Whale.
Oh, that's a good one.
I know it was a good one. I did it based on the VeggieTales movie.
Oh yes.
How do you know about this?
I mean,
this is a
quick story. My sister, who's 29. Just had her adult bat mitzvah.
That's a thing.
Well, she threw it. She just wanted the party, and she wanted.
That's exactly my 12-year-old self did that for the exact reason.
Exactly.
What was your theme?
Yeah.
Oh, I...
Was it musical theater?
I didn't have a theme, but if I could, it would have been musical theater.
Great. Yeah. Good. And I'm actually really glad that you didn't have a theme, because my sister didn't really have a theme for hers.
Themes are a little weird sometimes. They get a little weird.
They get a little weird, and I feel like you're going to look back, and it's always going to be embarrassing.
I wanted to wear a pantsuit. That is a thing I wanted to do. Cool. But I didn't end up doing it.
That's okay. And this was, what, 5 years ago? 2012?
I was 2012, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, and you know what? That's awesome, and I'm glad that feels very contemporary for you not to have a theme. My sister did not either, but she, she just wanted the party, and it was so fun. Yeah. It was great.
She married a Jewish man.
She married a Jewish man. Yeah. She wanted to convert. She was. Does it mean anything to you? I'm just. Oh my God, no. I'm being that person. Does it mean anything to you when I say that she's such a Charlotte? No.
Oh my God, I'm the worst Jew.
Don't worry.
He's referencing Sex in the City.
And it's... Oh, I love Sex in the City.
Okay.
I thought that was like a Jewish term.
No,
Charlotte?
Like a Torah thing? No, yeah, she's a Charlotte. Like, she converted to Judaism.
Oh, I completely understand.
Okay, great. And I'm so sorry that I had to ask, and that I feel like such a fucking...
Oh, no.
No, you weren't, because
totally
honestly,
okay.
there's people our age who haven't
seen Sex in the City.
People our age who don't understand.
That honestly was before our time as well.
It was.
A little bit. I mean, that was literally the first show where women all sat, and that was like one of the first shows passing the Bechdel test.
There you go.
Or even trying.
Yeah. Totally.
And that was a rerun show for us.
Well, here's the thing, Ruby. We were told that you know everything. I mean, like, you that you have a pretty.
Oh my God, that's a lot of pressure.
Not
we
everything.
We were told you know everything.
We were told that you have a very broad scope of popular culture.
Yes.
Would you say that's true? Okay, good.
I would say that's true, partly because I like to spend my free time in my room watching Netflix series.
Great.
So I just feel like I am cultured because I just like have seen mostly everything.
And your mother is this prolific magazine editor, founder, you know.
Yes.
And so you are passed down this sort of pop culture.
Yeah. Well, I also just like I've always had an interest in what's happening in society.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and that really comes through in the book.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, a lot of... The reason I really wanted to write this and agreed to writing it was because there are so many people talking about teenagers and writing about teenagers and being like, generation whatever we are,
yeah.
Like, all these things about us, but like, no one knows anything about us really because no one's living through it.
Right.
We're really one of the first generations to truly live through Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook in its like, ultimate prime.
Right, where it's all encompassing.
Where every single one of those apps is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I felt like I didn't want to be that person who was like, I understand teenagers. I'm with you guys.
Uh-huh.
I literally, truthfully wanted to just be like, no, these are my experiences. Here's some humor and like, here's some advice.
Right. So you're saying that you wrote this book with this sort of point of view of it not being tied necessarily to like this very esoteric, like mysterious part of teen culture that is like app heavy. You just wanted to write something like...
Well, the other thing is like people don't seem to understand that like, yeah, we have social media. Yeah, there's all these new things. But at the same time, like we're still teenagers.
Totally.
And you all were teenagers once. And really, yeah, there's social media, but it all comes down to the same five things everyone else was freaking about when they were teenagers, which is parties, whoever they like, school, their family, and then whatever their extracurriculars are and getting into college.
Totally.
Like, truly, other than that, there's not that much that we care about.
When I was reading the book today, I was thinking to myself while I was reading it, you know, there's not too much in here that's very different from what we went through, I think. I mean... Just to run through some of the topics. I mean, yes, there is a new lens on it.
Of course.
But, you know, it's about social media bullying. There's a lot about it. You know, she has a large section about just unrequited love and, like, going through that. So I guess, like, my question for you, but then there's also topics which we didn't even talk about as teens, which is, you know, embracing feminism.
Oh, my God.
You know,
oh my God.
And I think this is amazing for people not only your age to have your voice say to them, but also it's cool for people our age and older to hear that this generation is talking about these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And also having those dialogues. So my question to you is, who do you want to read who's the audience for this book? Who do you hope will read the book? And what do you want them to get from it?
I feel like I want a variety of different people to read this book. Mm-hmm. I feel like obviously, the ideal person to read this book is a teenager who feels like they have no one else to talk to.
Mm.
Because a lot of what being a teenager is no matter how many people love you, no matter how great your life is, you still have moments where you're like, wow, I have no one. Mm-hmm. Even if you have the most loving family, even if you have the best friend in the world, it doesn't matter. Mm. Whatever you're feeling is so extreme in the moment, but everyone tells you that you can't feel those feelings. Mm-hmm. All adults will just be like, you're hormonal. Things are just happening. You're just, none of this is going to matter in 10 years. But the thing is, it matters now.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And obviously, and I say this in the first chapter of the book, none of my problems are real problems. I am totally privileged. Like, none of these things are real issues, but they feel really real to me, and I'm going to talk about them.
Oh, my God. I mean, and that never, I mean, not to, like, sound too ominous, but that never goes away. That always stays with you. And, like, those problems will, like, ripple out into your life in the future that has implications on future work that you're going to put out. Mm-hmm. Like, on every, just, no. I mean, yeah, I totally agree with you.
When you're growing up, in those 4 years in high school, that is the most you're going to grow as a person in your entire life. Mm-hmm. You are going through the most changes in those 4 years than you will ever that fast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you grow up, and yeah, things happen, but the way you are raised and the person you become because of those years literally affects the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that because people are just so obsessed with statistics and what's happening with teens and what's cool.
Yeah.
But no one's taking time to be like, here is the actual emotions and what's really happening in the mind of a teenager.
And I think that's why I hope that people that our age and older read it too.
Because exactly.
It's an actual account from someone that's your age. And to be honest with you, I was thinking to myself earlier today, I was like, when's the last time I talked to a 17-year-old?
Yeah.
You know what
and
I mean?
Really, like, talked to them, not just like a, so how's school? Like,
yeah.
Really
yeah.
Had an actual conversation, because people don't think that teenagers have minds because they're just like, oh, young people.
Yeah.
But like, no, like, all of my friends can have good conversations with people above the age of 18.
Yeah. Right.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Oh,
now,
yeah.
That being said, well, before we got on the air, we talked a little bit about, you know, this year, we're talking about Hillary's book. We were talking about, you know, politics in general in some roundabout way. We were talking about how this year you're going to be taking the AP U.S. Government and History. Mm-hmm. Or U.S. history.
Yeah.
Or is it government?
Is
it government? It's U.S. government. Well, U.S. history was last year. This year it's U.S. government.
So, yeah, ooh. Right. AP Gov.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I also took this class, and I took it in 2007. So this was
Obama.
When Obama was rising. Mm-hmm, you know, this mm-hmm. was when it was either going to be Hillary or Obama. And, you know, obviously we were faced with McCain. And I actually, Sarah Palin didn't become a thing until college, but it was, I remember thinking to myself, I wonder what my AP Gov class would say about this, because I actually went to school with people who would have defended someone like Sarah Palin. Now, this brings me to this question. So you're in these classes right now where you have these kinds of opinions from everyone about politics. Now, I, from my perspective, looking back, I sometimes think to myself, like, wow, how insane that a group of 17-year-olds were asked their political opinions. However, I think what I'm actually saying to myself is, wow, how insane that a group of 17-year-olds were so conservative. Because I went to school on Long Island. So, like, what's it like where, you know, you'd think it was progressive, but it's actually rather conservative.
Yeah.
So what's it like right now? What's the political climate right now
in that class?
in your AP Gov class?
Well, like, the thing is about... I'm growing up in New York,
exactly.
Which is the most liberal place
yep.
you could possibly go to school.
And then you're going to LaGuardia, which is just
which is even
specific,
more yeah. Mm-hmm. liberal. Yeah, LaGuardia is a performing arts high school.
Right.
So everyone at the school has dyed hair. Everyone's very culturally aware, very politically correct. Mm-hmm. Like, you will get attacked if you say the wrong thing
yes.
ever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, with that being said, in these AP Gov classes, it is rare that there will ever be someone who is not a Democrat or
yeah.
doesn't have very liberal Democratic views.
Right. Hmm.
But what happens in these classes is someone will say something in the wrong way, something that has clearly good intentions,
yep.
comes out, is weird, is worded wrong.
Right, right.
They get attacked.
Uh-huh.
Like, people go off on them. I had a girl in my class today talk about how we can't attack Trump supporters because then we're stooping to their level, and that their people, even though they like have believe what they believe, and you know, I like understood what she was saying. I mean, like, I kind of agree in a way, but there were some people in my class who were like, "Oh, so you support racists? You support racism?" Sure, like all this stuff, and I was like, "Okay, let's take a step back. Mm-hmm. Let's breathe a little bit. Talk about something else."
Yep.
But that's it's either it's so funny because teenagers now are almost too politically correct.
Yeah.
Like we're so socially aware to the point where it's like people don't even it doesn't even seem like people want to be politically correct anymore for the sake of actually being politically correct. People just seem to really
the righteousness want, yeah, they people, get off on it.
Yeah, people like want to be like, "No, I know more about feminism than you do."
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we're losing touch of actual activism.
Yep.
Because activism, and if you're actually not a racist and if you're actually a feminist, you just want equality. You want people to just have good morals and be good people, which a lot of people aren't, which is their thing. But people get to a point where they start attacking each other.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if we want activism, if we want to make a change, we need to talk to each other and have a conversation and be open-minded and be allowed to listen to each other's opinions and take them in and have a calm, civilized conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're all so self-righteous and so entitled to our opinions that no one can seem to be able to take in what anyone else is saying.
Totally. I mean, it's so interesting that you say this, and because I was talking to this good friend over the weekend, we were taking a walk in the park, and he is this sort of I won't say his name, but he is this pretty, like, you know, prolific sort of presence, and like some would even call him a social justice warrior, not even pejoratively, but just like that's part of his, like,
on social media,
and he's just well known in that regard. And he even realized, and the reason I'm not saying his name because I feel like maybe this is like a sort of a semi-controversial thing to say, but he was just like, "I feel like everyone is just losing their minds, even on our side." Like, he was just at this pride event in this small town, and then there was a group of activists who were there who like went up to him and questioned him, and they were like, and it was just like a normal pride event talk, like talking about like being a person of color who's queer, and this group of people go up to him and they're like, and they're just, and what he notices is that they're trying to find their words. Mm-hmm. And they're these young people who are just like struggling to be like, to just figure out what to say to him and be like, how do you stay in your lane, you know, like how do you stay woke but stay like, you know, and they were just sort of like pulling these borrowed terms or these passed down terms, and it's like, and I think what this person realized was, oh, everyone is a little bit confused and a little bit frenzied because we're all figuring this out as we go, like, yeah. Everyone across all age groups, across all, like, you know, political backgrounds, whatever.
They're losing how to express themselves.
Yeah.
Because I think we're still figuring out how to. And I think that applies to everybody.
Well, also, so much of, like, what I talk about in the book and so much of what's going to help my generation really make progress, mm-hmm. in activism, mm-hmm. is having a voice and using that voice to your advantage. But if people are afraid to use their voices because they're afraid of getting attacked or being called aggressive,
yep.
or any of these things, people aren't going to speak up because they're afraid, because they're afraid they're going to be wrong or be politically incorrect. But the thing is, if you're politically incorrect, let's have a conversation about it. Let's talk about it. Let's work through it together. But instead, everyone has just converted to this fear factor,
yeah.
because everyone's so afraid of saying the wrong thing, when really we should say the wrong thing, get corrected, and then work our views out.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a problem that, you know, the right wing doesn't have, because it seems like they are able to just march in the, like, someone who's like really happy, really proud to like put a Confederate flag on their house can and who doesn't maybe understand what that means will just proudly walk next to a member of the literal KKK in the streets, and it seems like nothing goes through their heads.
And no one else on their side is going to be like, "Hey, that's actually a problem."
Yeah, they're not going to call each other. They're not having these discussions. They just mobilize and go, and it's, I think, a reason why they, for better or worse, seem to get things done. Whereas on our side, it feels like, you know, still to this day, I mean, with what Hillary says in her book about Bernie and the way that the Bernie people are responding to her even now, mm-hmm. and the jumping down on Kamala Harris before she can even be a candidate, it feels it's a huge reason why we can't get things done, is because it seems like it's stopping conversation from happening.
Totally.
And the other thing is, like, everything I'm saying is directed towards people who, like, have the kind of views I have. Like, obviously, it's a very different conversation if we're talking about someone who is actually a racist or actually a misogynistic person. Mm-hmm. Everything I'm saying is, I know a lot of people who really want to be politically correct, but they just don't have the information or the resources to understand what that means or what feminism really means or what it means to be a racist or not be a racist. Mm-hmm. So everything I'm saying is directed towards the people who actively want to be politically correct and be people who have views that are progressive. The people who don't have those views, that's another conversation, because those are people who have been raised that way. Mm-hmm. They've been raised that way, the way I've been raised to be a feminist.
Yeah.
And you can't change me. If someone came up to me and calmly started to speak to me about being anti-feminism, being racist, I would obviously be like, absolutely not, you psychopath. But in terms of making progress on the liberal side of America, we can't make we will only make progress if we do it together. And if we're splitting each other up because some people are more liberal than others, that's not progress.
Yeah.
That is actually going backwards.
Yeah. It's sort of fragmented.
Now, I do have another question about your AP Gov class. Y'all know you have a test to take at the end of the year, right?
Sadly.
So here's the deal. When they put that test in front of us at the end of the year in 2007, I looked down at that test. We hadn't talked about any of it.
Come on. That's a
thought. We hadn't talked about any
of it.
That's
on your teacher.
100%. But we had had so many conversations about whether it was going to be Barack or Hillary, and like whether or not we should be pro-choice. My teacher got us up one day and was like, okay, everyone who's pro-choice, get on that side
that
of the
room. That is a horrible
and
idea.
Everyone
That's
who's
terrible.
Pro-life, get on this side of the room. And if you're undecided, stay in the middle. He did this about issues. And then I
that
was just like,
that is maybe the worst thing a teacher could possibly
do. He was not good. And oftentimes, like, and it's, I responded to one thing in your book. You were talking about how you had this teacher. This is in the book, and this is so fucked up.
Okay, wait.
So Ruby has this. Actually, you know, do we have to take a break?
No. Let's talk.
Let me say this tidbit, and then we'll take a short break. So, a teacher of about 30 years old, you said, was speaking with you, and then recommended to you that you not be too feminist because it comes off as unattractive.
Yes.
Oh! A teacher!
Yes. This happened. She also called me a dumb blonde for 2 years. Just so you all know, I'm a brunette.
But Ruby was 11.
Yeah, I was a child.
God. And the thing is, these teachers are everywhere. Everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I had them in my high school on Long Island. Like, you had them in your, like,
middle
New
school,
York.
Yeah.
New York City middle school.
York City, most progressive middle school you could possibly go to.
Don't be too much of one of those feminists because it could be unattractive or aggressive.
Yeah, I was taking a women's suffrage class at the time, and she pulled me over, and she was like, yeah, because that was, like, the social studies course that I was taking.
And she taught
and
that
she,
class?
No.
Oh, okay,
she was,
okay.
like, she was one of my, like, teachers that
sure.
was one of the teachers at my school.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, I'm really excited because I'm taking this awesome women's suffrage class. And she pulls me over and she's like, just so you know, men really don't find feminists attractive. You're gonna, don't become one of those aggressive feminists, you know? And I was like, what?
Let me tell you, I had a teacher one time in high school. And we just gotta say this. And so listen, we were talking about Ann Coulter, who's literally the garbage of the earth. So she had said something about how like all the Jews in the world need to convert to Christianity. Yeah, yeah, like you know, her whole MO, sure, like she just was going on about that. And I was talking about how sick that was. And my teacher at the end of class pulled me aside and he said to me, "The thing is, everyone does need to convert to Christianity because then there won't be any more cancer in the world and any more sickness." And I was looking in his eyes and I was like, "Oh, you're like a religious, like,
oh,
that's,
my God.
You know, that's
freak.
Like against the law, right?"
Yeah, I mean, it was fully against the law, except I didn't know how to handle it at the time. Like, I kind of was just like, okay. And I left the room and I think I ran down the hall. I was just like, that was so freaking scary.
That's shocking. And you know what? I mean, if there's any comeuppance here, both of those teachers are being put on blast now. And Ruby, right. Your teacher is being put on blast in your fucking book.
Yes.
So there you go. Oh, my God.
And we'll talk more about the book, and we'll talk more to Ruby Carp, who I'm so loving this conversation.
I love this convo.
Thank you.
And we will talk more right after this short, brief, abbreviated break.
Okay. And we're back with Ruby Carp. Now, Ruby, we want to talk to you. We want to ask you the question we ask all of our guests, and we're doing this in Act 2, which is great, which is... Ruby, what is the culture that made you say culture is for me?
This is the culture that made you decide to step in a cultural direction. You said to yourself, wow, I love media. I love film, music, television, the stage, cultural life.
What have you?
What have you?
It's a weird question, but it's great.
For me, it was definitely being raised by a single mom.
Great.
I love that.
Because the thing is, when you are Rory and Lorelai Gilmore,
yeah,
you are living a very different life than basically everyone else.
Yeah,
because the thing is, I grew up always being encouraged to talk about my feelings and tell my mom everything that was happening in my life and tell her all the drama that was happening and everyone that was being mean to me. So from a very young age, I was open to talking and I was open to discussion and wanted to have conversations with people and really learn about them, because my mom would do this thing where when I was little, even though I would be talking about nothing, my mom would just ask me about my day and let me just talk for as long as I wanted, so that from a really young age, she was always encouraging me to express what I was thinking.
That's such a great answer. And that is so Gilmore Girls. And because you're saying that made everything else fall into place for you. Like,
yeah,
your love of movies, you know, comedy, everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh.
Self-expression,
great,
in general, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I think maybe because there are two parents, when I'm asked how my day was, it's like, well, it's a different story for each one of you. So I'm not going
to
say it at all.
Yeah, well, because especially when I was younger, it was like, it was no matter what was happening, it was my mom and I against the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
my mom was my best friend. Now it's like my roommate. Like,
yeah,
obviously she's still my mom. We fight all the time. But now it's like we're sisters. Like, we know each other so well to the point where it's like there's no question of whether or not I'm telling her about my day. She just knows everything.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I tell her everything in that she trusts me to have no curfew, to come home when I want, because she knows where I am, because I'm telling her what's happening.
Yeah.
Okay. So the relationship we have is based in trust.
And you're very honest with her.
And I'm very honest with her. Because the thing is, like, I'm not a bad kid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing I really need to hide from her.
Yeah.
And all of the things that I'm doing are teenage things. I go out with my friends. I have fun nights. I go to the movies with people.
You write books.
I write books. Like, all teenage things. And my mom also, I work pretty hard and stuff. So my mom lets me be rewarded with not being very lenient about curfew and coming home and stuff like that, and really having that sense of independence, having my own room, really being my own person has made me who I am, because without that sense of independence and really learning what it means to be alone but still have a lot of love in my life has really just shaped me as a person.
That's beautiful.
Gotta love it.
Oh.
So you told me you're studying drama at LaGuardia.
Yeah.
But acting is not necessarily like
the route.
The
yeah.
thing.
Well, for me, I just kind of, I feel like in terms of breakout star, like
yeah,
roles
right.
and stuff, I really I mean, I'm not going to speak for the future because, like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I really, I love writing, and I also love television and really studying what people react to and what works, and I feel like if I'm going to act and be on TV, it's going to be my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or what I, like, my character that I'm writing for me.
And that's the direction everything's going in anyway, so you're all set.
What are you liking on TV now? What shows are you liking?
Well, I don't really watch that much live television. I really watch a lot of Netflix.
Yes.
So what are you binge?
What are you catching
up on? Okay, so right now I'm in the middle of Handmaid's Tale. It is crazy.
Yes, it is crazy.
It is. I am so, oh my God, so much is happening. We're also discussing it in my film class right now in school.
Oh my God,
which
I
is
wish.
So awesome. It's so, so awesome, cool. Right?
I wish I had done that.
It's
I
so
always
fun.
Ached for that when I was in high school, like to have a class where we could, I mean, in my AP Lit class one time, my AP Lit teacher, like, exposed us to Stephen Sondheim. We started talking about Sweeney Todd. And then I went to go see the movie, and I was important. I couldn't wait to come back to class to talk about it.
Yeah.
But to have a whole class about stuff like
that.
Oh
my God, it's so great because we just have conversations about all this stuff. Uh-huh. It's so fun. But I've been binging Parks and Rec for like the second time, The Office for like the fourth time.
Mm.
Secret Guilty Pleasure, Gossip Girl, Gilmore Girls, all those.
Yes.
Weirdly, I like go in and out of Grey's Anatomy. Sometimes it's
you're talking
too
to two
much.
Grey's queens right here.
Yeah,
well, back when it was good.
Exactly. I'm trying How I Met Your Mother. I'm trying everything that's on Netflix.
So
basically.
You really are like trying to like broaden your scope. It's like I was saying earlier. Like, you really are trying to like get this good media diet of stuff that's come. That's not necessarily of your time, and I'm not saying, I'm just saying that it's like, like it was on like when you were certain. It's like when we watched like Cheers.
It nailed but like Grey's Anatomy when we were 16, 17 absolutely nailed me to the wall.
Oh yeah.
But that's because that was season 2 and 3.
Yeah.
That's
essentially like, because for me, it's all about finding my voice in terms of writing, because my voice in terms of stand-up comedy is very self-deprecating.
Yeah.
Like my humor is, My view on humor is, why offend anyone else when you can just offend yourself?
Great.
Because everyone, especially now, everything's a trigger for people and everything brings things up for people. So why make fun of other people when you can just make fun of yourself?
Well, there's no risk of like, you know.
When there's no risk of, and also it's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fun to just like laugh at yourself and tell funny stories of things that happen to you. Mm-hmm. But in terms of television, my favorite movies are like Frances Ha and Manhattan and Moonrise Kingdom and movies like that. And I really want to one day find the median between Frances Ha and Parks and Recreation.
Oh, great.
That's pretty specific.
That's a really
cool.
good zone.
Oh, that, I mean, like, yeah, because that's like a crazy median. That's like, where do you find that one? I mean, I love, like, I've been watching Girls because I think the way it's done, directed, written, everything about it is so exactly what I hope to be one day.
Yeah, that's great.
Girls is a game changer.
Oh, yeah, and because the thing is, there are so few, and that's why I love Master of None, there are so few people making comedy shows that are based in truth and based in real things, that the way real people actually are.
Yes, and like, there's this thing of like comedy auteurs now on TV, and I feel like Girls, I don't think it paved the way for this show, but
in a sense.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about? Insecure?
Insecure. I was going to suggest it to you. Have you started watching Insecure?
No, what's that?
It's a show with Issa Rae. It's based on her web series called Awkward Black Girl. It's essentially like, I don't want to like dumb it down this way, but it's essentially,
it's Girls in L.A.
Girls in L.A. Like, it's like an all black cast. It's really, really great. It feels like, like, what would you describe? Almost like the second season feels a little bit like Sex and the City.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like,
there's just a lot of like love triangles. It's really fun to watch. It's one of those
I'm
shows.
I'm a big lover of rom-coms.
You'll
really like the show. It's also a really, and I don't know how much of this you've experienced in high school and stuff, but it's a really good examination on what it means to be faithful and what happens when someone cheats.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the psychology of that. Mm-hmm. I just think it's really good. And I actually tried to watch it a year ago, and I kind of didn't give it a chance because I just didn't buy it. Tonally, I wasn't on board. But I gave it a shot again like 2 or 3 days ago, and I love it.
And all of this weekend I was binging through Atlanta. And that is another show I think it might be sort of the closest thing that's in that liminal space between Frances Ha and Parks and Rec, you said?
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's oh, it's interesting. It's funny, it's absurd, but it's also like so textured and real in that way. I think you would love Atlanta. It's like there's some like crazy fucking shit that happens in the show, but I think you would love it. I think it's, if you can handle Handmaid's Tale, you can handle Atlanta. It's really, really good, and I think it's like operating in that space that you kind of want to go for.
Yeah, exactly. Also, like the new season of Master of None, I loved, because it tackled real life problems, both socially, like politically and stuff.
Yeah.
But also just real moments. Like, he was freaking out about one girl and then ran into his ex-girlfriend who he hadn't thought about in a while on the street.
Yeah.
Because that's a thing that happens.
Yeah.
You just, like, you're freaking out about something and then you run into someone who you totally don't expect to see but have thought about so much. Like, those are, such a real moment. Yeah. That's such a thing that happens, especially in New York.
Ruby, has that happened to you a lot?
No, my God. No, I don't mean it like that. I just mean, like, there are so many moments in the show that are so, and like when he's freaking out about the girl and then he starts writing a pros and cons list and then he's like, wait. No, I like her. Like, there's nothing I can do about that. Like, just, like, little things like that, that it's, like, the show is so funny.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are so many moments where he just lets the show get real.
Yeah.
And I think that for so long, a sitcom was, like, a funny show where people make jokes and, like, sit around and drink coffee.
Uh-huh.
But, like, now we're finally realizing that comedy is about truth.
Yeah.
And comedy is based in reality.
Yes.
And without that base reality, there's no comedy because there's nothing to make fun of. So I think the fact that we're finally making shows that appreciate that and that, like, really bring that out is such a big deal.
That's so cool that this stuff is resonating with you, especially at, and I'm sorry to bring up your age again, but at your age, you know, it's like that, but that's very encouraging. And,
it's huge.
It's huge. Like,
thank you.
It's such a good time for everybody, but, like, especially for, like, people who are, like, going to be sort of, you know, not defined by this era, but, like, sort of, it's going to texturize their
well
voices.
Also, when you're 17 and when you're a teenager and young, you're feeling everything you're feeling for the first time. So everything you're feeling is so intense because we've never felt it before, which is why your first love, your first heartbreak, your first everything resonates with you so much, because you've never experienced it before. So your emotions are so heightened because you don't know how to deal with it.
And you become so impressionable with what you consume media-wise, because for me, Grey's Anatomy was, like, the first show that, like, fucking blew my fucking mind. I was like, this is the best show I've ever seen in my life. It was so crazy. And, like, now looking back, it's like, I have such nostalgia for it, but it's like, it's
no,
just
no, no, no. I will say, the second season of it, the production value was way higher than what they give it now. Now it's fucking Meredith Grey standing in front of a green screen, and she's like, it's great to be in front of a waterfall.
Yeah.
It's like, bullshit. They spend no money on it now because they didn't know that they don't have to.
I know.
Back in the day, it was like, Remember that ferry disaster?
Oh my God. Well, that was in front
of a
green screen.
Who could forget? Yes, definitely. But, like, that was, like, the last throes of them having, like, a budget.
This fucking moment. The fucking Code Black episode where there's a literal fucking explosion in the hallway, and that was a real explosion, and I was like, Jesus.
How about
Christ.
When two people got stuck on a pole and one of them had to die?
That was the first episode I ever watched of Grey's Anatomy, and I was like, this show is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
and
that
girl
episode.
that girl should have won an Emmy too.
She should have,
but didn't.
God.
Wait, I have a question for you. Do you have a lot of gay friends in high school?
It's LaGuardia, but I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe you don't.
You would be surprised at how many kids are straight at a performing arts school in the drama department.
Oh,
because
wow.
because you think they haven't come out yet, or because you think they're legitimately straight, and
no,
it's okay.
I think you can tell us. I think they're legitimately. Here's the thing. I have a lot of gay friends because I went to performing arts camp.
There you go.
Which is so different than performing arts high school, because the thing is about performing arts high school is that a lot of these kids either aren't out yet or honestly, because the thing is, it's not that I don't talk to people or don't see people outside of my department, but it's really hard to have classes with people not in the same department as you, so you don't really mingle that much outside of your department. And really, in the drama department, especially in my grade, there's not that many kids who are out.
Sure.
Which is fine.
It's
which is totally okay.
Yeah.
performing arts camp, though, uh-huh. the ratio of straight boys to straight girls.
Yep.
Actually, no. Ratio of straight boys to not straight boys is 0 to 1 million.
Ah. That's wild. Like, and that's got to be frustrating for someone who's at camp.
Oh, my God.
Know,
you have no idea. Oh, you have no idea. I think there were maybe two straight boys at camp who I don't even know if they're straight, but they weren't even that attractive, and they got girls all summer.
And they will continue to keep putting themselves at performing arts camp. Rule number 19 of culture. Straight boys, you want some? Go to performing arts camp.
Sorry.
But that's, see, I ask you that because I feel like, if I'm in high school and Ruby's there, I go befriend Ruby.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
That's how I feel. I feel like you'd be a great friend for a gay kid.
I mean, you're just an interesting female. And honestly, like, I'm not saying that that's all it takes, but it's like that you gravitate towards that.
No, but I feel like also there's a lot of people in high school that are like, they're super smart and dynamic, but that's also closeted. You know what I mean? Like, that's another thing.
Well,
that stays inside when you're closeted by your sexuality is you also don't say how you feel and don't say what you think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting to talk to you and hear all of this because I think about myself at that age and I think, wow, I was close to being ready to be myself and say the things I thought.
Thing that's hard about high school is that people make their friends and then they don't really feel the need to go outside of those friends that they've made.
For sure.
Yeah.
Like I really didn't find my group of friends until like last year, and even then I don't really have a specific group. I kind of just have friends that I like who I hang out with.
Yeah.
And like they all hang out with different people. The problem with conversation is I don't say these things in class.
Right.
The impression people at school have of me is I raise my hand all the time because I always have something to say about whatever book we're reading or whatever U.S. government topic we're talking about. So people at my school are like, oh, yeah, that girl, the one, the teacher's pet. When really, like, I could care less about what a teacher thinks of me.
Yeah.
I want to, like, have a conversation and, like, discuss Handmaid's Tale and, like, really talk about Trump. But the thing is, everyone's so focused on seeming cool and not seeming like they're too aggressive that when people get very passionate about their points, everyone's like, oh, yeah, this guy again.
Yeah, totally.
Making friends in high school, it's not that it's hard. It's just difficult to make new friends outside of friends you haven't had for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when, you know, you feel like everyone has decided who everyone is already.
Exactly.
You'll go to college. I mean, where do you want to go?
I'm only applying to 6 schools. I'm applying early action, which just means I'm applying early. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, right.
It's not an early decision.
Yeah, it's not an early decision. I'm applying early to Emerson for comedy.
Oh, great.
Because they have a comedy major, which is awesome.
They've got good alums.
And it's in Boston. I can continue comedy and stuff.
Right.
That'd be awesome. But I'm applying to Yale, Wesleyan, Columbia College Chicago, Northwestern, USC, and Emerson, and not NYU.
Don't worry.
We went to NYU. And
but Columbia College. So
just don't.
I grew up in the city, and I don't have the money.
No, go to Emerson.
Go somewhere else.
Let's pray I get in, guys.
Yeah. You will be fine.
Wait, okay. Say those schools again, because those are all pretty good
comedy
schools.
I know that. Well, I want to be a comic. So, like, I'm applying. The thing is, there's no comedy major at schools other than Emerson and Columbia College Chicago. So if I go to school, hey, everyone, learn about my college future life. So I think I'm going to major in film for those schools that I don't major in comedy.
So when did you go to Emerson and see it and everything already?
Yeah, I toured.
So you toured. And when you toured, what did they say the comedy curriculum is like? Like, who teaches there? Like, what is that?
Yeah, it's a sketch writing curriculum.
Cool.
So not like not the whole thing, but basically you have a class in improv, you have a class on history of comedy, you have a class on writer's room. They basically teach you everything you need to know and help you craft a portfolio to go into the real world and just pursue comedy.
There you go.
Huge.
That's huge. So basically I went to school for writing at NYU and you had to fight to get into classes that were like that. And I went to school for it at NYU and literally major with a concentration in television writing at NYU Tisch, dramatic writing. And I didn't even ever get to take a late night writing course because it was competitive to get into and I was in the department.
Yeah.
And it was alphabetical the way they decided who got
the
classes
that's
and my
so
name
dumb.
Started with R. So yeah, by all means, you should totally go
there. A lot of people have been telling me mixed things about majoring in something like comedy because the thing is, I mean, you can't learn comedy. You have to learn it.
Yeah.
Obviously. But comedy isn't a thing that you can take a class in. You have to learn it through doing it. You form your stand-up act by trying it out on people.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you have to master your craft.
Mm-hmm. And you're gaining so much practical
knowledge. Yeah, exactly. And you need to build a portfolio. You need to learn how to be in an ensemble. You need to learn how to not think you're the best person in the room.
Oh my God.
There are a lot of things that you need to learn. A lot of people have been like, no, major in something else. You'll get material for your comedy. But I don't think it's about that. I think it's about really learning the format of writing and sketch writing and all of the different kinds of improv and teams and all of the different things that go into it to really go out into the world and be a formed, understanding comedian.
There is an academic and classical training knowledge to it. There is 100%.
It's a history of comedy. People who take theater BFAs, they have to take history of acting. Mm-hmm. They have to learn all of that. Comedy's the same thing, just more concentrated. Yeah.
It just feels frivolous, and you're like, oh, you don't have to do that.
And you're like, oh, comedy, okay.
Right. But it's actually huge. What?
There's going to be a lot of comics listening to this wishing that they could have gone to, or could still go to, Emerson.
I mean, we have some Emerson alums who have been on the show.
That were comedy majors?
I don't know if Sunita.
Comedy major is literally a new thing. Really new. It literally started a year or two ago.
But it's still so cool. Can you imagine going to one class and it's sketch writing and another class and it's
improv?
I have
friends who are freshmen there and literally they were like, oh yeah, our 8 a.m. tomorrow is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road? And it's literally a joke writing class.
Whatever.
That's so funny.
And I was
huge.
Oh my God.
And so I can't put a price tag on a fucking professor telling me or an adjunct, whatever, just being like, learn to be humble, you asshole. If someone had told me that, I don't know, just way ahead of time, what huge.
Also,
deal.
Someone being you don't need a spec script of Parks and Rec. What you need is a writing sample of your own shit.
Yeah.
Which we were still writing fucking 30 Rocks.
I mean, when we were in college, it was all about the specs, all about the spec script for an existing show, and it's totally
they don't look at
now.
That anymore.
It's wild, yeah.
Well, it's also, it's not even about, because you can't teach someone how to write. That's a natural thing.
You have to do it.
You have to do it, but you have to learn about who's done it before to find your own voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. I used to want to go to college for writing, but the thing is, I don't think anyone can teach you how to write. It's just about learning the formats and then finding who you are through that.
But God,
that sounds so weird.
No, that's Anne Lamott right there.
All the reviews of my book have been great book, cliche person, and I've been
oh my God.
Oh, well, because...
Is that what they say?
Yeah, well, all the reviews have been 3.5 or 4 out of 5 stars because they've been sometimes the book gets a little cliche, and I'm it's an inspiring book. What do you expect?
And I was 16 when I wrote it, so it's not cliche at all, you fucking jag. That's what I would have said. Oh my God, that's stupid, Ruby.
So you've decided to read the reviews.
Oh, here's the thing. I am a people pleaser. I literally have a heart attack when people are mad at me or don't like me,
which is
awesome because I want to go into the entertainment industry, which is maybe the worst place to be for someone like me, but that's okay. It's awesome.
That's how we all are.
I'm a very, very, very sensitive person.
Yes,
I will hold on to grudges. I will remember everything. I have done a lot of cool things in my life. I only remember the times that I've messed them up.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And you know what? This is just something that you will also learn that maybe they'll fucking teach you in college is that just that is something that you just steel yourself against. I would say I'm the same way as you, Ruby, in that basic way. Maybe Matt is too, but we've had to learn, like, don't read the comments. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't...
I learned that the hard way when I was literally 13.
I mean...
Because I wrote an article for Mashable when I was 13 about how teens aren't using Facebook anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I literally, like, kind of got death threats. And it was awful. And I would read all the comments because, like, no one told me not to. Mm-hmm. And then Tavi Gevinson, I was, like, I was interviewing her. We used to both, like, be in the Hello Giggles world, so, like, we know each other. And I was talking to her on, like, a panel once, and she was like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
She was like, it will kill you. And the thing is, like, I read the reviews because I want to know what my friends are seeing when they look up the book.
That's a thing.
You know what I mean? Because the thing is, like, I don't really care about the reviews, but I care about my friends being like, oh yeah, the book's not even that good. Because that sounds awful and like I shouldn't think that, but like I do because I'm still in high school. Like it's not like I wrote the book and now I'm off. Like it's like, no, I'm still in school every day. I have to go home right now and do my AP government homework. I have like I'm still a student and like people follow me on Instagram and I'll go to parties and I'll see people and they'll be like, hey, you're publishing a book, right? And I'll be like, oh my God, let's die now.
Yeah.
And
well, that won't go away either. You're always going to want to be in the know. You're never going to want people to, like, know things about you that you don't. You know what I mean? That's what it is.
Exactly. And the thing is, like, reviews hurt a lot because it's like, you know, I'll read them and I'll be like, do you understand that I spent a year of my life, like, putting everything I had and, like, all of my personal stories? Because if you read the book, like, it's very personal. Mm-hmm. It's about the common teenager, but I said to myself before I started writing the book, there is no way I can write a book about all teenagers and not talk about my personal self experiences. Because I say this in the first chapter.
You do.
I'm so sorry. I'm not a girl who likes girls. I'm not a boy who likes boys or a boy who likes girls. I can only tell you what I've been through.
Yes.
And I can only tell you my personal experiences. Mm-hmm. So I use what I've gone through to just help people get through what they're going through. I can't know what it's like to live in a household where there's five people in it. Mm-hmm. I've grown up with just my mom. The family chapter was the hardest chapter I had to write because I had no idea how to relate to people who didn't have relationships with their parents, but also people who had dads who were present, people who had siblings. I had no idea what to do.
Yep.
And then the way I figured it out was just like, talk about me. Talk about what I've been through and how I got through it.
And be honest with that. And then on the flip side of that, it's like just like how you feel like, well, there's no way I can speak to all of these different experiences. Like, I mean, there is some onus on the reader to just be open-minded and accept your experience as something that they should hear about because they should. And so, like, we fully hear you. And, like,
I think it's super cool. And I encourage, so cool. I've read quite a bit of it today. I really encourage everyone that's listening to pre-order the book, Earth Hates Me. What does the title mean to you?
Earth Hates Me? So originally the book was titled Bratty, which is my mom's nickname for me growing up. But then in one of my chapters, I write, and in the heartbreak chapter, I was like, sometimes I wake up and I feel like the earth hates me because everyone hates me going on some stupid rant. And then... the woman who is the book cover designer was reading through the book to get a sense of the book so that she could figure out what the design was going to be. Uh-huh. And she was like, hey, I know you like the title you came up with, but what do you think of Earth Hates Me? Uh-huh. It was a line in one of your chapters, and I really think it's funny.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that is so my book. It's self-deprecating, which is exactly my humor and basically is the whole book, and also it's exactly what every teenager feels like.
Oh yeah, but it's so funny and specific to that sentiment at that age, and I think it's a fantastic title.
Thank you.
Well, you should all pre-order the book Earth Hates Me. It is in stores on October 3rd. Earth Hates Me: True Confessions from a Teenage Girl. It is super great, and I think it's really, really cool to, like you said, hear a perspective from someone that is your age on this stuff. And it's nice to check in and understand that, like, you know, they're having the discussions too about what it means to be, what the word cisgendered means.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, these things aren't just exclusive to, and I think in the millennial generation, we get kind of wrapped up in ourselves. These aren't conversations that we're only having. It's a worldwide discussion, and it's super exciting, and the book is awesome. Let's move on to I Don't Think So, Honey.
Okay.
Okay.
So, Ruby, I explained this to you a little bit. So this is, I don't think it's funny, this is our segment where we take 1 minute to rail against culture. We've done a live show with this. We'll have to have you on the next one.
Yes.
Cool. We'll make sure it's a venue we can get you into.
Ooh.
That's some shade.
That's not shade. No, we will be accommodating.
We'll be like, she's 28! And that's that.
You're giving us a look like, God, these people.
But
yes, we will get you in the next live show.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
God.
So basically, it's called I Don't Think So, Honey. I'll get a fake ID.
Get a fake ID. Just for that.
Do you have one?
She can't say.
The silence is deafening.
Ooh.
Anyway. So yeah, we take 1 minute to rail against something in culture. I loved what idea you had before. I don't know, maybe it's changed, but we're going to go one by one. Bowen Yang, would you like to start?
I don't have one ready, do you?
I guess I could do one.
Okay, all right. Let me get the timer for you. Here we go.
Oh, man.
What's that?
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. It's going to be on theme for this episode.
So we're just going to repeat I Don't Think So, Honey as many times as possible as we eviscerate this topic. This is Matt Rogers' I Don't Think So, Honey. Time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, almost all of the teachers from my high school. I'm putting you all on blast. Mr. Brown, you only wanted to be our friend.
Oh,
I'm sorry. AP Gov, Mr. Brown, you had a test to prepare us for, and you just reveled in watching everyone tear each other apart. And you know what? You were the tennis coach and you did nothing. I Don't Think So, Honey, Mr. Brown. I Don't Think So, Honey, Mr. Riley, my tech teacher, who engaged in a Facebook comment fight right before the election and post the election with my friends. And then you got into a huge fight and you are not on the right side. I Don't Think So, Honey, Mr. Riley. And also, I believed in you and you abandoned me senior year when I needed you as my track coach.
Oh, my God.
And I had shitty track coach my senior year. I Don't Think So, Honey, you, Mr. Riley. I Don't Think So, Honey, Mr. Rosado, who was my cross-country coach in high school. You tried to use me for political reasons that I can't remember, but I remember that it wasn't good. I Don't Think So, Honey,
5 seconds.
The woman who ran the education department and English department who took the job away from my AP Lit teacher because she didn't show enough movies.
And
fuck you, she was amazing.
1 minute. That is
I don't think so, honey. ISIP high school teachers.
Power plays.
Oh my God.
In high school.
You have no idea.
My God,
they use power plays.
These teachers abuse their power.
Oh. Yes, they do. And also, it's like House of Cards.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They try to machinate and manipulate.
Ooh.
Is machinate a word or is it machinate?
Sure. Oh, who cares? Whatever it means to you.
Okay, bitch. Well, it means to me that they are trying to double cross. Because I remember that we had like a student union president that was one of the teachers in the school, and then to gain his favor, like teachers would do shady things, and I was like, this is not about the students.
No.
And when you're a senior and you come of age, you know that's true.
You do. Okay, I think we're sticking to a theme here.
Okay, are you going for it?
I'm going for it, but I'm gonna focus on one. Okay, here we go.
Okay, Bowen Yang, I Don't Think So, Honey. Time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey. Dr. Peggy Lane, who insisted on her calling on us, her students, calling her Dr. Lane because, yeah, cool, she had her PhD in English literature, whatever the fuck, but she kept lording it over us and making, and you know what? Here's what she did. Talk about power plays. She politicized the entire class because here's what she did. She would always, every class, say, Maria Zaleski, she's superior. Guys, you got to follow her example.
30 seconds.
She's writing these really cogent arguments about Steinbeck or fucking who knows what. And she made us feel bad. She shamed us in class for not reading the books, which maybe she should have shamed us for anyway. Who knows?
15 seconds.
But I Don't Think So, Honey. Dr. Lane, she talked like a fucking cartoon mouse. And she was... She was ridiculous, and everyone hated her, and she intimidated all of her students.
Definitely in 5 seconds.
That is not the nurturing environment that you should be fostering in your schools, in a public school. I Don't Think So, Honey, Dr. Lane.
That's 1 minute, Bowen Yang.
Oh, my God. I have a lot of pent-up resentment for her. And
you do.
I wish her well, but she was ultimately a benevolent force, but also the way she went about things was pit her students against each other, and I don't like that.
You, I Don't Think So, Honey, a woman who had a doctorate and only wanted the respect that she was owed. And you
but was
should
she owed
live
respect?
In shame.
Was she owed that? Because my mom, fucking, she has her doctorate, and she doesn't insist. Same goes for my dad.
I call her Dr. Yang. I call her on the phone every night.
But she wouldn't care if you didn't, and that's my point. Some people demand respect when it's not necessarily totally earned, is it?
Earn the spec.
There you go. Earn the spec.
That's rule number 108 of culture.
Earn the spec. Coined by one Ruby Carp. Thank you, Ruby.
And I want to throw one more teacher under the bus. Mr. Holdsworth, you used to make the quote-unquote cute girls sit in the princess chair in the front of our social studies room.
Yeah,
whenever a girl was
so
acting.
So many things are illegal at that school.
Yeah, you would make them sit in the princess chair.
Oh.
And then our principal, Dr. Eileen Rossman, came to our classroom one day and said that had to stop. And you know what? It did.
Should have happened to begin
And it did stop. And teachers of the world, if you are isolating female students and putting them in a chair in front of the room,
calling it the princess chair.
I don't think so, honey.
Thank you.
Now it seems like Ruby's ready to go.
Okay.
This is I Don't Think So, Honey, Ruby Carp. Time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, college application process. Excuse me, the SAT. Thank you for defining my intelligence based off of a singular test. What happens? My test is 7 hours long because I have anxiety, so I get 7 hours of the SAT. Excuse me, no calculator section? Are you kidding me? Defining who I am based off of my math grades? Based off of a 650-word essay about who I am when you don't even know me?
30 seconds.
But yeah, please define my intelligence, Harvard. Have you seen the movie The Hunting Ground? You suck, Harvard. Anyways, also, how are you supposed to define how I am as a writer based off of how I analyze an SAT essay?
50 seconds.
Are you kidding me? Authors who have written SAT articles have tried to take the SAT about their articles and failed.
Five seconds.
SAT is corrupt, and as well as the college process. There you go.
Oh boy, that is 1 minute. I think now they'll stop doing it.
Ooh.
They'll stop administering it now, Rube.
We're setting this because of me.
Because of my I Don't Think So, Honey.
All it takes is one voice to take down the College Board. Let me tell you something. That is just a money-making machine. All they care about is money. That's all it is.
Yes, it's a money-making machine. And the thing is, I consider myself a pretty intelligent person.
Yes.
But the thing is, because everything now in education is memorization and test-taking, it's not education. It's just memorization. And then colleges are seeing my scores and my grades, which is like a 90 average and like a 1300, which to Yale is not enough.
Ugh.
And the thing is, it's like, you know what? What if during high school I published a book, I did a comedy show, but you know what? That's not enough for those schools because my grades and my scores don't define that.
Did you take the ACT?
SAT.
But take the ACT. That's my...
No, I couldn't. I couldn't.
Because you couldn't?
Specific schools.
But also, I have anxiety, so I need extra time on tests or I will fail.
Uh-huh.
And the ACT denied me extra time.
Oh,
because they didn't believe I actually had anxiety.
Oh, my God.
A week before they test, they revoked my extra time because they were like, you're lying about having anxiety.
What?
And wait, I was like, what?
Hey, ACT, we here at Las Culturistas believe women. And when they say they have anxiety issues around testing,
would
then you
like
believe
me
them.
To have a panic attack in front of you?
Yeah,
like, I don't know what to tell you. I brought a note from my therapist.
Yeah,
like,
I don't understand what it would take.
No, I don't know. Oh, my God, that's bullshit.
But I say I recommend it because it's actual test based on comprehensive knowledge and not just like
the
fucking witchcraft and wizardry of the SAT, which is a game.
Yeah, a week. I studied for the ACT all year. A week before the test, they sent me a letter that was, sorry, you can't have extra time. And I literally can't take the test without it or I like legitimately would fail.
Oh my God.
That sucks.
Let me tell you something. I got a perfect score on the ACT.
What? Oh my God.
Because it's a bullshit exam and you're not missing anything. And if I could get a perfect score on that,
you got a 36?
I got a 36.
Oh my God.
Look.
I got a 31. I thought I was a champion.
That's really good. But look, here's the thing, Ruby. All the stuff about you publishing a book, about you performing, about you doing all these amazing, incredible things, that goes in the personal statement and you're fine.
Thank you.
I hope that...
Emerson, you be a fool.
If you don't take Ruby Carp, I Don't Think So, Honey, don't even think about trying to come on Las Culturistas Emerson College.
The entire faculty of Emerson.
And they've all been emailing. Okay, so this has been so fun. You guys, the second Monday of every month, haul your ass over to UCB East and you check out We hope you have fun, which is the stand-up show hosted by Ruby, and pre-order Earth Hates Me Now, which is in stores on October 3rd.
Ruby, thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are huge fans, and we hope we've made other fans out of our listeners. And my name is Bowen Yang.
My name is Smith Black.
Smith Black. That's Ruby Carp.
Yeah.
And Lizette Rogers. Bye.
Bye.
Forever. This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Joe Cilio, Alex Ramsey, and Brett Boehm. For more podcasts, please visit foreverdogproductions.com.